This is Let's Talk Business with your hosts, Mark Ebinger and Heather Bain. Now, here's Mark.
Welcome to Let's Talk Business, a show that highlights and promotes entrepreneurs to learn more about their vision, goals, and marketing strategy. Coming up on the show today, we're going to learn about starting and running a family law practice. In studio with us today is Linda Leeser, a divorce and custody attorney and the owner of Family Matters Law Firm. Linda, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so glad you invited me.
You bet. I'm excited. And you dressed very, very dapper, as Kian would have us say. So she got all dressed. I feel underdressed, actually.
I had court this morning.
And I matched you today. I was wondering, will he wear short sleeve or long sleeve? I always try to match it.
Yeah, but your shirt looks wrinkled. Did you even iron it?
No, I don't iron.
God, you're too much of a... Well, you're living that bachelor life.
You got to get that steamer. The steamer's quick. That's what I do.
That's right. Okay, I'm going to
next time.
That.
I don't know.
$6.
To get a steamer sponsor.
Yeah.
I'm your host, Mark Ebinger, the owner of Krukus Virtual Staffing, a company that specializes in hiring virtual assistants from outside the United States.
I am Heather Baim, owner of Onset Professional Development, a coaching and training company that drives clarity and insight for small and medium-sized businesses that allows them to take confident action for change.
And you have a brand reveal coming up soon. So give me 30 seconds of what's going on there.
We're having our brand reveal on March 26th at 5:30 p.m., and it's a networking mixer. So we're going to have 75 to 100 business owners here in the community come out, celebrate, network, and reveal our brand, because Genevieve's still working on it.
Yeah.
So I couldn't mark it with my logo because it doesn't exist yet.
Where's it going to be?
It's going to be here at VentureX Northwest in the 8th floor lobby.
Time and date?
March 26th at 5:30 to 7:30. Yeah.
All right.
That was in the spiel.
You want to tell the time and date a third time, Heather?
Yeah. Well, hey, people have to hear things.
They do.
Thrice. You know what I'm saying?
And
thrice.
That's why I'm going to say these things three times.
Yeah.
My name's Howie Nestel. I own Starkmatic Advertising, a cool ad agency serious about big results. Going on my somewhat like 30th year in marketing, before the internet was invented, we were doing radio, television, print, billboards. But now we do mostly digital. We've completed 1,100 websites, Mark. You'd be happy to know that. We've worked with 1,500 clients. And my goal is to take entrepreneurs and grow their influence through digital marketing.
I love it when you talk about the DIYers, as somebody's nephew's brother's friend's cousin's sister that's going to build the website for you. And really, we're at a point now where website development, it really, if you want to function well, you've got to plan and execute well, and then you have to maintain and optimize on a regular basis.
That's correct. If not, nobody's going to see it. It's like winking at somebody in the dark. You can build a website, but nobody knows what you're doing, except for you, but you're not preaching to yourself. So you want a website that looks good, functions well, and that people who don't know you get to see it on the internet. And that's done through optimization. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot of people that tell me like, oh no, Howie, I have a website. My cousin's son took a class at SAC and he built my website for $500.
Oh, 500. Well, at least he paid for it.
Yeah. I mean, exactly.
All right. So a quick reminder to follow the Let's Talk Business podcast on all major podcast platforms and social media where you can catch video versions of the show. We just hit over 20,000, or right at that 20,000 mark, YouTube subscribers, so we're excited about that. You can get to everything easily by visiting our website at satalkradio.com. And then also, we've got this big mixer coming up on May 16th of this year over at Project Coworks Central off of Morocco. It's going to be a celebration, of course, of the podcast, but then also a huge mixing opportunity for local businesses, entrepreneurs, and so forth, which is going to be from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Over at Project Coworks Central. See how I said it twice there?
You did. So,
Howie, are you going?
I've already marked myself as going.
Yeah.
And I'm so excited that last time it was not called a mega mixer, but there were so many people that attended it that we had to add mega mixer to the name.
Yeah.
And what really gives me like happiness is that we donated money to a nonprofit. So we charged everybody $10 to attend it, which you got your money back right away because just from two margaritas, that's already $20 worth of value. But we took 100% of the door proceeds and donated them to the Children's Rehabilitation Institute, Rehabilitation Center for Children with Disabilities. This next time, the $10 are going to go to Discovery Camps, a camp for kids battling cancer. It's a sleepaway summer camp for a week. And it's 100% free for the children. And they get to be with other kids that are also battling cancer for a week. And the $2,000 we'll donate will go directly to the camp.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. And, of course, if you're buying tickets, buy two. Bring somebody with you. You know what I mean? We've got plenty of room.
And it'll sell out. It sold out last time, and we had people calling us that day. Oh, and I'm sorry that I didn't. I'm like, dude, it sold out.
Mm-hmm. Yep, so. Yep. Heather, you going to be there too, I would imagine?
I do plan on being there, yes. It was a great event last time, and it'll be an even better one this time.
Yeah, and we'll make sure you get your new logo on the I'm going to level up the game in a couple of different areas. I've got some cool stuff in mind for you guys, but then also for the video that's going to be playing on loop. I want to tighten that up a little bit, make that a little bit better.
One thing that the attendees who were not there the first time should know about the hosts of the Let's Talk Business podcast is that we're your personal concierge to introduce you to other business people, because between the five of us, are there five co-hosts, six?
There's five co-hosts five. And then there's me, yeah.
Yeah. We know everybody in the room. And so we'll introduce you to people that you don't know. So even if you come solo, know that you're going to leave knowing other people.
And when we did an episode about specifically networking and how to utilize networking and walk into a room and make the most use of that event last week. So it should have just dropped today.
Yeah, episode 185.
So that'll be a good one if anybody's hesitant about networking or wants to figure out why should I go to this thing. We did a whole 30, 45-minute episode on that, and that should have some great nuggets of wisdom for whoever's out there.
That's something that is missed when it comes to going to a mixer, is having those, what was that fancy word, concierge?
Concierge. Your personal concierge. But personal having somebody, concierge.
So my vision for this is people are going to come in, we're going to have a huge red carpet area, right? And then the hosts of the show are going to be meeting and greeting everybody along that red carpet, whatever. But then also, that's that first touch, that first introduction. And then it's a matter of, hey, introducing. Because now everybody knows, because for the couple that may not know, that you guys are hosts of the show. So then they're expecting to see you. And when you come over, they're going to be excited to talk, whatever. And then we start making those connections. But doing that in a mixer, I think, is huge. And it's something that I have not seen before.
Well, it's not done. Usually you just go, you walk in, there's a ton of people, and then you're looking for the bar.
Yeah. And you just kind of start conversations.
Yeah, it's a different vibe when you got people like us going and kind of scraping the edges of the mixer and forcing them inside with the, you know, obnoxious audacity.
Yes.
But that intentional enthusiasm. Right.
That's probably a better way to say it.
Well, I learned that from Sunny this morning on the other show. But all right. So Linda Leeser, so you've been in, I want to get a little bit of your background.
Okay.
Kind of what your story is as far as what led you to law and then specifically family law, because I know it's a great story there. So can we start?
Okay. Well, I'm what we call a second career attorney. In fact, I didn't even go to law school until I turned 50.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yes. Yes. We had a situation where my grandson, his mother, not my daughter, took him. We couldn't find him for about a year. And eventually we received a phone call from Child Protective Services letting us know that he was pretty much fighting for his life. At that time, my son was recovering from a traumatic brain injury, and he couldn't take custody of his son. He asked me to step in and get custody. And so, of course, I did. I mean, who wouldn't? But what I found when I was doing it is I was on attorney number four by the time we were ready to go to jury trial. Mm. And I ended up going to jury trial without an attorney.
You represented yourself.
Yeah, I had no choice. I ended up representing myself. And, you know, person who represents himself has a fool for a client, and I lost.
Oh, no.
But through that process, believe me, I read every code book, every case, everything there was to learn, and I was able to get it overturned on appeal. But that process, one, showed me I could do it, showed me I enjoyed doing it, but more importantly, I learned that there were a lot of grandparents out there like me. Or fathers out there like me trying to fight to get their child into a safe home. And so I decided to go into law school at that point in time. And it's a good decision.
So wow. There's a lot of authentic passion and drive for what you're doing there.
Yeah.
So you start got into law. Did you go right into that particular kind of family law, or did you something else first?
No, I went to law school to go into family law. And I came out and I opened up my own firm so that I could practice family law differently than what I had experienced, where your client is a client and not a case.
So what are some of the deficiencies that you saw when you were ended up having to represent yourself? Give us like two or three of those main points that you're like, this is ridiculous. People will go into real estate and other things because they see that this isn't how it's supposed to be. But give us some examples of what those irritations or those big problems were that you wanted to fix with your own practice.
I think family law attorneys see so much bad on a daily basis. They hear so many complaints on a daily basis, and some of them are silly complaints, like mom fed the child Fruit Loops for breakfast. Some of them are serious, but I think attorneys, they get worn down. They get worn down. They begin to see, well, this is just how it happens, and this is just what the court's going to do. And I think they lose a little bit of that passion, a little bit of that humanity. And I tell you, I have to fight to keep that passion and that humanity. After hearing about this kind of stuff day in, day out, it's something you have to fight to keep. But I think that's the big one, is we forget that for our client, that is the only case that matters. Their children are the only children that matter. And it doesn't matter if a judge is normally going to rule that way. We still have to fight for what our client wants. And that was kind of the deficiency I was seeing, is the attorneys knew or felt they knew what the judge was going to do. They felt grandparents' rights cases, they're like the most difficult cases. If you're lucky, 1% of those cases are winnable, right? Because we have a fundamental right as parents to determine who raises our kids and sees our kids. So those are very difficult. And so when you get difficult cases like that, their minds keep going back to, well, I'm only going to win. I only have a 1% chance of winning. But there's more than just winning that final thing to the family. To the family, as long as a case is going on, there's oversight by the court. And when there's oversight by the court, the children are safer. And so it may not be about winning custody for the grandparents. It's about protecting the children through the process. And winning is awesome, but I mean, it's not the only goal.
Can I?
One more question I want to make sure this part gets hit on is the, how do you keep yourself like refreshed? How do you not get worn out? What is your thing, or give us an idea how you keep that spirit going?
So I'm a graduate of the Jerry Spence Trial Lawyers College, which is kind of a very exclusive college of litigators. And what they practice there is psychodrama. So when things start getting really tough, I'll attend one of their psychodrama sessions and work through the issues in a confidential manner with other attorneys. And so that kind of is really helpful. And the other thing is I just spend as much time as I can with my grandkids, because that there rejuvenates me.
Well, it sounds like you've got a way of kind of like holding the boundary lines between your work, your super emotionally charged work, and your personal life and your you time. How did that go, establishing that? Is it something that because you had a different career, you were more able to do? Because I feel like you see a lot of super burnt out lawyers who do not have that boundary between life and work.
Yes. I think it's because, you know, I'd been in Fortune 500 companies for 25 years prior. So I had a lot of experience of setting aside work time and family life. I also think coming in as, I'm going to use the word mature instead of old, a mature person going to law school, I was viewing things differently, right? Because I'd already had a lifetime. I'd already had 50 years of experience. And I think that's what helps me. I don't need to be the top attorney in the firm. I don't need to be on a partnership track. You know, I was already set at 50. So it was just kind of, this is what I'm doing because of passion, not for dollars. I mean, obviously I like to get paid, but I'm doing it because I saw a need. And I still see that need. And so I still do it.
Mm-hmm. I have about 37 questions I'd like to ask you.
And moving your mic a little closer. By
the way, one of my favorite books, if you all haven't read, a parable called The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari, is about an overworked attorney and all the stuff he does and how his way of breaking out was to become a monk. So it wasn't that he was a monk and sold his Ferrari, but no spoiler alert, but you guys read it. It's a super easy read. But we all want to find our passion in career, in life. You coming from the corporate world, things are pretty rational most of the time in the business world, especially in corporate. Then you come to family law and you're dealing with irrational animals that are making usually a scorched earth policy decision to ruin everybody's life. And I've seen that among friends that, you know, corporate executives, then they're getting divorced, then the custody battle begins, and one of them moves to New York, takes the kid without permission, and there's all kinds of, I'm like, are these the same human beings that were working in Fortune 500 companies? They are, but somehow the brain makes a complete 180 and you become completely irrational. And you're right. I've had friends tell me like, oh my God, and the mom or the dad, and then this, and I bought Nike socks. They didn't bring back the socks, so they're writing down how many pairs of socks there is at the other person's house. And so how does that, I mean, were your expectations met when you said, look, I want to do something that I'm passionate about, I care about the families, I care about the kids, and then you got in it, and now you've been in it for how long?
9 years.
9 years. You know, have your expectations of finding your passion job or career been met?
So, yeah, I mean, the satisfying cases are the smaller percentage of cases. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of drama in every case. We're seeing good people at their worst. Divorce is a very difficult emotional battle, even when you're the person that files and wants the divorce. It's a difficult time. It's the death of something. And so there is a mourning process. And so we'll see that. The anger, the revenge, the acceptance, and definitely the writing down the items that were not returned. And yes, Nike socks are actually on those lists.
Yeah.
But you get good cases. They're, not that all cases aren't good. You get some cases that just become so special to your heart that it helps you deal with the drama in other people's life. We set some real boundaries at our firm that we won't become attached to the drama. We care about our clients, and we don't want to charge them our rates to get involved in their drama. They're better off with a therapist, not an attorney. And we'll let them know. We can talk about this list of items that didn't come back that equal $72. But at our rates, you're actually spending more money talking about the list. When you treat your clients, which is kind of one of the things I would have liked to have seen when I was a client, but when you treat your clients as human beings that are intelligent, because they are, and you put it in terms of this is what it's costing you, and I'm not your therapist, a lot of that drama doesn't come into the office and is held in for the courtroom, where the drama is, where you should have the opportunity to tell your story.
Have you referred clients to Guardian House?
Yes.
Exchange with Children?
Guardian House, KidShare.
KidShare, yeah.
So
I didn't know these organizations existed until I chaired a gala for Guardian House. And apparently you need neutral places where each parent can drop off their kid, court-ordered time. And then some of them, at least Guardian House, has parenting classes. And it's part of the judge's mandate or whatever. They have to take some parenting classes. But it's incredible. They have to have sheriffs there. One parent comes in from one room. One comes from another one. They stagger the times so that the parents don't see each other. They're not seeing the other car, and they're not following them.
Well, if you go to the libraries now, too, they have, like, Wi-Fi parking spots And that was a big driver of that initiative, was parents coming to sit and exchange kids in a neutral location and like not wanting to go in, but like sometimes sitting there for a while waiting on the other parent. And so they started making little Wi-Fi car slots. I like them. I used to use them as a realtor because I'd be like, yes, I can write my contract. But there was a deeper reason. I have a question, because I tend to go on the more pragmatic side, especially if I'm highly emotional. Like I try to like lean back on logic. And I, with those kind of situations, I could just see you start to expose some of the flaws in the greater system and see some of the like pain points. Does that ever infect you? Like I would just be like, can I fix the root of the problem in the system here? And like those things in the legal, and especially with CPS, I know there's a lot of things that could use some fixing. Is that anything that's on your radar? Or are you truly just focused on the client?
What's your next career? What office are you running for?
What are you going to change?
Not running for judge.
Right.
Not planning to work for CPS. I can't imagine what a difficult job it is for CPS, but they are also broken. We have federal judge Jack out here telling us we got to change our system. It's a broken system, but how we fix that is, I'm clueless. I'm hoping to help the system by bringing in attorneys to work for me and to help change the aggressive, we got to win, to a more collaborative law type process where the parents get together, because they're parents. They should be making the decision. If they're good parents, then their decisions are what should be being made. And so I'm trying to maybe soften the field a little bit by hoping to train other attorneys to come in and be more of a collaborative approach, to remember we're not the ones going through the divorce, it's our client. And so we don't need to argue with opposing counsel. They're not our ex-spouse or soon-to-be ex-spouse. So I don't think I can fix the system. I don't think there's – the only way to fix the system is to get rid of divorce.
Hmm.
Right?
So on that, though, looking for attorneys –
Or do we get rid of marriage?
Yeah.
Oh, well,
then we don't have to worry about
Howie's wife
divorce.
Listening, being like, excuse me.
At least you didn't say get rid of kids. Yeah. That would have been weird.
Yeah. So marriage is not as common as it used to be. The younger generation – everybody's younger generation than me – but the younger generation's not getting married. But they are not avoiding the situation because they're still buying houses having children.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Common law, right? Just comes into effect there, right?
Well, common law, you have to have an intent to be married.
Oh, really?
Oh.
Right.
Because it was less, it was more gray as a cop. It was like, oh, well, you know what I mean? We get the family violence calls. It definitely fits that because you guys are shacked up together. But it's nice to hear that there's an intent required for that part of it.
There
that old technical
intent.
Language you learned in the police force. Yeah.
Yeah, a few
cop
words.
Shacking up together.
What? I was a cop, not an attorney.
Well, I know, but and I was going to ask you, like, what interaction had you had as a police officer with either attorneys or with, you know, some of these safe houses to get kids out of? Because I've always heard that domestic violence calls are usually the most dangerous for police officers.
Well, they are because they're highly charged, highly emotional. Mm. You know what I mean? People are not rational when it comes to family disturbance calls, which could be family violence calls. But, yeah, most of the interaction on that's negative. The interaction with the, you know, battered women's shelter or whatever is let's turn them over get to the next call. So it's not a whole lot of, you know, involvement on our side with some of that.
But did they try to tell you their problems also as they're in your car, as you're driving them somewhere, like you're the therapist also?
Yeah,
like
especially, from both sides, really, but I think more of that from the guy as he's on his way down to the jailhouse, which is usually what happened, you know what I mean, if there was some violence involved, which is why we were out there, most likely. But, yeah, I'm not a huge fan of getting involved with family stuff because it's very, very sensitive. But I never had a negative encounter with an attorney, and I just never had any attorneys that would show up because it was too fast, too quick, and then I didn't do any follow-up when it came to the court stuff. So I didn't have really much there. But I think San Antonio, my opinion, fantastic city when it comes to the SAFE unit, because we're making more time for that. And we got the crisis intervention team as well now, which helps with a lot of this stuff that goes on in the homes. And then there's lots of nonprofit type stuff out there to help facilitate But I agree from a cop's perspective that the system, when it comes to CPS, very much broken. It's almost like a last resort to have to go into that system at all, because it's just extremely, in my opinion, very negative and dark. And it, I don't know how much good comes out. There's probably some, but I don't know.
Do you give? Do you find yourself giving advice, even things that they didn't, that your clients don't ask for, and trying to mediate before you do the court stuff?
Right, yes. Of course, I give my clients advice on how to conduct themselves during the pendency of the suit, because that's important.
Because the judges can tell, right? If they walk into court and they start, you know, yelling all kinds of obscenities and make accusations, it says more about your client than it would about
what happens. So the poor judges, I really do feel for the judges. You know, they get maybe an hour or two to make a decision on these children's lives, an hour or two. Sometimes you can get longer, but, you know, most cases are handled in the courtroom within a two-hour period. And the judge has to decide, was there domestic violence, was there child abuse, all in a two-hour period. I can't imagine how difficult that is. Howie, I'm so sorry. I forgot your question.
Oh, yeah. Well, just about the advice that you give the families. And do you ever have the opportunity to advise the opposing client? You know what I mean? Do you ever sit down with them and say, hey, listen, you know, look, we're not trying to win here. What we're trying to do is find something that's going to be the best for your child.
So obviously I can advise my clients and do on questions they ask and also on things they don't ask that I have learned from opposing counsel or from the documents I've received. If it is a pro se party, meaning they don't have an attorney, then I'm allowed to talk to them and I can negotiate with them. If they are represented by an attorney, I cannot talk to the opposing party without that attorney's permission.
Mm-hmm.
Nor can they talk to my client. But we try to mediate every case before going to court. The courts really strongly recommend it. Plus, it's better because, again, the mediation process helps the parents learn to co-parent again. It also helps them because they get to tell their story to the mediator. So they've gotten their story out. And telling your story is very important. It's an important part of the process of a divorce. Once you can get that story out, you begin to accept that you're going to get divorced, and now you're willing to make concessions and settle. And a lot of the drama goes out after you've been able to tell your story. And so now you can move on to a new phase in your family life, because you're still a family, right? You're still a family when you have children, but you can move on to that new phase. So, yes, I do try mediation in almost every single case because it's best for my client.
So I have a philosophy, and I tell my kids this, and I tell my staff this too. A successful compromise is when nobody got what they wanted. If there's one person in the room who got everything they wanted, it's not successful, because I guarantee there's other people who are very dissatisfied. Mm-hmm. So when my kids tell me, like, well, Dad, that's not what I wanted, I go, I didn't get what I wanted either. And so, but what can we all agree to that's not what you wanted, not what I wanted, not what Mom wants? You're like, okay.
So let me bring this back around to the business side of it a little bit, and then we'll get into some definitions. But so when it comes to building out a law practice, mm-hmm. right, what is your approach to this? We talked before the show about, you know, you're not really looking for partners at this point, which I think is an interesting strategy, and mm-hmm. I actually agree with it. But so let's dig into your approach to building out your family law practice.
Okay. So law school's great, but they don't teach you anything about business, running a business, opening a business, nothing. So I hired a business coach, how to manage. They do nothing but law firms.
Oh, awesome.
They understand the marketing restrictions that law firms have. We have, you know, there are barristry laws that prevent us from doing a lot of different marketing. So I do have the coach with the fractional CEO that help keep me, they help keep my emotions out of running the business, because as a business owner, you shouldn't let emotions make your decisions. So they've helped me with that. Currently, I have one attorney, so we're a very small firm. But our goal is, at the end of a five-year period, to have 10 attorneys. I want to be considered a mid-sized law firm in the next 10 years. And so I'm actively recruiting advertising for attorneys right now. Definitely, anybody out there listening, looking for Spanish-speaking attorneys? Family law experience, not necessary. because family law is a law that any attorney can learn. We just need trial experience. That's the important part. But so I have an office manager that handles all the bookkeeping, all the billing, and the client interface. I have a personal assistant that handles my calendar, travel arrangement, light typing for me. And then I have the attorney that, my Spanish-speaking attorney, and that handles the lighter cases. And when I say lighter cases, I mean those cases that aren't contested, where the parties agree on what's going to happen. It's a matter of just approaching the judge and getting the judge to sign off on the order. But so, we're really moving up to wanting 10 at the end of 5 years.
And what kind of cases are you taking?
What kind of cases are we taking? So we take family law cases, your divorces, your custody cases, termination and adoptions for step-parents or grandparents or a family member. We don't do adoptions where the parties don't know each other. And there's another whole set of law, and if that's something somebody wants, they need to go to an attorney that, I can't use the word specializes, but concentrates in that area. But we'll do the step-parent adoption, the grandparents' adoptions, that kind of stuff. We do CPS cases where we represent the parents. We don't represent the children, but we do represent the parents in CPS cases. We also do some estate planning and probate. And let's see. The cases that are near and dear to my heart are kind of what we call enforcement cases. And those are the cases where a party, normally the father, is being denied access to his children against court orders, where the other party has decided on their own that they no longer want the children to see that other party. And so those are the ones that are near and dear to me, because when you don't have two set of eyes on children, children are more in danger. So I guess what we would call father's rights cases. A lot of father's rights cases, a lot of reuniting children back with their dads.
And that seems like it stems from what happened with your son and your grandson. Mm-hmm. And so I can see that. Do you use that to stick with Mark's theme about how to tie this back into business? Do you use that as your differentiator in terms of how you market? Do you have that story on your website? Do you talk about it? Because it was so compelling. I mean, my jaw dropped when you were telling us that story. And it seems like if I was in a situation like that, I would want to hire somebody who has that kind of fire and that kind of drive. You said as a business owner, you keep emotion out of it. I say keep the negative emotions out of business, but definitely bring with you passion and enthusiasm and that kind of stuff.
So I do use my story to market light. My grandson's going to be out there looking at websites and things, right? He was a toddler. He doesn't know what happened.
Right.
Yeah, you don't want to go into explicit detail about his life.
Well, but he's going to hear it somewhere. Why as well hear it from you?
Right, and he's 19. He knows something happened.
Oh, there we go.
Right. He knows something happened. I just don't want to put the details out there. That is something he needs to come to me for when he's ready.
Right.
Yeah, it's his story.
Yeah. So I do have a light version out there on my website. I do. Definitely when grandparents and fathers come in with a similar situation, I let them know I have sat in your seat before. I don't know exactly what you're going through, but I can definitely empathize because I've sat there. And I know how important this particular case is to you because I've sat there. So I do use that light. I just don't want to get too much of that out there for my grandson's mental health.
And are you finding you have, more business than you can handle, which is why you want to bring on, or you're looking to drum up more demand?
Both. I mean, we have a full docket, right? But that's when you start bringing in another mm-hmm. attorney and build up another full docket.
Now, that brings me to another question that I've been dying to ask, but it hasn't been the right time. So earlier on, you mentioned that you want to change the way your lawyers work to be a more collaborative type of lawyer. Mm-hmm. And in general, trial law has a certain personality type. contentious is probably a good word for it, right? Those type of personalities don't generally default to collaborative, whatever the word is. So how are you identifying those lawyers when you bring them onto your firm that will be interested in collaborating versus being a little bit more contentious to other lawyers?
So our hiring process, we start out with a written questionnaire. After we've received the resume, we set out a written questionnaire, and we kind of look for culture fit through that written questionnaire. If they talk nothing about how they won, you know, the last 5,500 cases they've done, then we know that winning is more important to them than representing the client. There's a difference between winning and representing your client. First of all, in family law, there is no such thing as winning. When it comes to divorce, there's no such thing. Nobody's a winner. Everybody lost something. And so I can see through that questionnaire if they're going to be able to fit into the company culture. And if they can, then we do a 3-interview process. They first interview with my office manager, then they interview with the attorneys underneath me, and then they interview with me. And if they've made it through those people as a good culture fit, then they should be able to come on board and do the more collaborative law.
Have you looked at bringing in an attorney from Mexico or Central America or South America? Because there's a lot of people leaving Latin America coming here, and there's some very smart attorneys. And obviously they learn English down there, so they're perfectly bilingual.
So first of all, if they wish to practice in the United States, then they have to get their LLM first, so they have to go back to law school to practice in the United States. They can't just take a bar. My attorney that's with me now is actually from Mexico, but he did go to law school here in the United States. Nice. But yes, I am not opposed to international lawyers at all, because I think they also bring a different thought process into it.
When I was younger, I wanted law was something that interested me, and business law in particular is my favorite class in college. It just didn't happen for me because I got transferred to the Philippines and got to experience a volcano blowing up, which was a lot of fun. But
well, you're still a young man.
Yeah.
So you can go to law school.
No, no, see, I like law school was the one Linda, hard Linda no sponsored. For me. Yeah. I even loved Legally Blonde growing up, but oh, it was me and my sister's favorite. I can still to this day say every line in that script along with the movie. I'm that girl. But law school was a no for me. It just never interested me at all. My husband was like ready to go be a lawyer, not me.
I like B-law, business law also, but I wasn't that good at my classes. I could barely pass history of rock and roll at UT. I'm like, I'm in law school. Gosh. You're crazy.
No, I combining a certain level of compassion with a drive to win. I think I have both of those qualities. So I don't know how I would do on your question.
You can't have me, but culturally, you don't fit at Family Matters. Thank you for applying.
We still want people who, when they go to court, are going to win.
Yeah, want that competitive drive.
We still want that. We just want people, attorneys who are open to the idea that that's not the only way to settle the
dispute. Having the best.
Sometimes you
outcome.
Get forced into having to be contentious. There's really no other way to handle it.
Yeah, having a spirit for, the best outcome for the whole family, is I think a really good approach. Let's talk a little bit about definitions here. So a standard possession order, what are we talking about there?
Okay, so a standard possession order talks about what type of visitation the parent who the children are not living with gets. And in Texas, a standard possession order is they get the first, third, and fifth weekend of every month, from 6 p.m. on Friday to 6 p.m. on Sunday. They also get every other spring break, every other Thanksgiving, and then Christmas is divided into 2 periods. And so they get the first period 1 year and the second period the other year, and then 30 days in the summer.
Okay.
And either Father's Day or Mother's Day weekend, depending upon their gender.
Now, how does that differ from a 50-50 possession order?
So a 50-50 is really the child is with each parent 50% of the time. And a 50-50 can work, the parents can agree to a 50-50 in any manner they want. But normally a 50-50 is either mom's house from Sunday at 6 p.m., to the following Sunday, and then dad's the next week, and they just keep rotating with some adjustments made for the holidays. Or mom on Mondays and Tuesdays, dad's on Wednesdays and Thursdays, and then every other weekend at the alternating parents.
That just seems like incredibly confusing for the child because you're being displaced constantly.
It could mean that a child never feels they really have a home. Mm. Older children seem to thrive in that environment because they're getting time with both the mom and the dad.
And they can get away with more. Mm-hmm. My brother used that very much to his advantage.
Well, mom said that. You know.
Well, and studies have shown that father role for teenagers is really important. Mom needs to be the caregiver, but dad, who's, you know, moms tend to be caregivers, and I hate to be gender, but it's these were what the studies show. Moms are caregivers, so we do for the kids. The dads hold the kids more accountable for doing for themselves. So they tend to roughhouse a little bit, and they tend to expose children to newer opportunities. So children need the balance of both. And so a 50-50 provides that.
What do you think, Callie?
Linda's, she's probably reading my texts because I texted with my kids. I took my daughter driving last night. She drove my Hummer. She had never driven before. You know, I didn't put it on social media so that my insurance guy doesn't see it. But, you know, I have her driving. First, we did a parking lot thing. And then she's like, you know, I've never driven before. She goes, which one's the gas again? I go, the one on the right. But first, I had her sitting on my lap. Then we drove around the parking lot. And then she drove, you know, and then drove in the neighborhood. And we're going to drive again today. So then my 17-year-old texts me, like, hey, Dad, can I go to the movies tomorrow with this girl or whatever? I go, yeah. I go, bring me home some good grades. That was my text back. Okay. He's in school, so he has a day and a half to get me at least a good grade or two, and then go to the movie. So you're right. I mean, you could be reading the playbook. Whereas traditionally, moms will do and take care and all that stuff. They still want their kids to be independent, but they also want them to be dependent on them. You know, whereas dads are like, come on. When I was your age, I walked barefoot in the snow uphill both ways. And we didn't even have happiness, and we were happy.
Well, let me make this harder then. So, I mean, if you've got, say you've got a 15-year-old boy, just as an example, and you're going into a broken home type situation because of a divorce, where should he go with the mom or the dad most of the time? Is it 50-50? What are your thoughts there?
Look, every kid needs both parents. Even if both parents are not great, most parents are not. We're trying to figure it out also as we go along. And so that's what happens. I'll tell you my personal experience, and I know Heather was alluding to hers a little bit and with her brother, but my parents got divorced when I was 15 and I was the oldest. That automatically catapulted me as the man of the house because my dad took off to another country and left us bankrupt, moved into an apartment. My grandfather had to step in to help out. But that's when I went from like, goofing off, Howie doesn't care about anything to like, and man, if my mom can't save me and my dad can't save me, I got to step up. And that's held to this day. I'm a saver. I plan. I'm, you know, street smart, you know, and I'm in business because I had to. And so I thank my dad who's just turned 90 and I thank him all the time. And he's like, you know, I wish that I had. I'm like, don't wish anything. I go, shit, I would have never gotten to where I am had you not done the things you did. Now, I know you didn't do them on purpose. I know that wasn't ideal back then. But I think at the end of the day, kids end up who they are. It's maybe 50% genetic and 50% environmental and what they do with their own. So,
do you know what I read, though, that freaked me out? Was that there's a certain level of trauma that is a common theme among highly successful people. And that if you look back in their childhood, they have some form of traumatic experiences. And I was looking at my little babies and I was like, well, crap.
Yeah. I mean, look.
How are you going to be traumatized?
Yeah, I was talking to somebody this morning about Dr. Wayne Dyer wrote 50 books, 35 bestsellers. He was in the foster care system. Mm-hmm. I have a kid right now who you know, and he tells a story, Braden, who's got a landscape company. When he was 15, he worked for a landscaper all throughout high school. Then he's barely 20. He's not even 21 yet, and he's had his own landscaping company for 2 years. He's bought his fourth piece of equipment, trucks, trailers. He has employees, and it's all because he didn't want to do without, and he knew that he felt like he wasn't smart enough or didn't have the opportunity to go to college. And so that became the driver. So, I mean, these kinds of things, sometimes they make you, sometimes they break you. And I don't know that there's a formula for it.
Welcome to life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so let's get back into definitions real quick. So, like, if a parent has 50-50 custody, how does that work for child support?
Okay, so that's most people assume if it's a 50-50 custody, there is no child support. And that is inaccurate. What the court can do is they can do an offset. So let's say parent A makes $100,000 a year and parent B makes $50,000 a year. So parent B is going to have to pay, I'm really bad at math because I'm an attorney, they're going to have to pay $300 a month in child support, and parent A is going to have to pay $600 a month in child support. So obviously, 600 minus 300 is 300. So parent A just pays parent B $300. Now, if parent A and parent B both make similar amounts, the court may not do an offset and say there is no child support. Other things the court may do if they don't want to do the offset is if the child's in private school, they could make one parent responsible for the private school. They can make a parent responsible for the daycare or medical insurance. So, but usually they'll do what we call an offset, where they take the two incomes and offset it, because the child needs a good quality of life in both homes. You know, if at 1 week a year, 1 week he's eaten nothing but ramen, and then the next week he goes and has steak and seafood, I mean, that disparity is not good for him.
Interesting. All right, so
take ramen off the list. Real quick.
Yeah, right.
It's a comfort food for me at this point.
That's hilarious.
I put chicken in it though.
Right.
I don't even there put anything in it. That's creative. Just like, this is delicious by itself.
Okay, so what is a geographic restriction, and can it be changed?
A geographic restriction can be changed. A geographic restriction is extremely common, and it just states that the children can't move beyond a certain point in time without further order of the court or written agreement of the parents. And normally the geographic restriction is going to be Bexar County and contiguous counties. So if you live in San Antonio, you cannot move the children to Austin without approval of the court. Definitely can't move them to New York without approval of the court.
And that happens a lot, right? Because people get divorced, then somebody connects with somebody else, or maybe to use police language, shacks up with somebody else. And then they're like, oh, my God, and we're moving to L.A., and we're taking the kids with us. Well, hold on 1 second.
Yes.
Can't leave Bexar County.
It does happen quite often. Yeah. And another is maybe a parent now has a better job opportunity that they couldn't take earlier in another state. And if you have a good reason for that move and you can show it's in the best interest of the children to move with you, a court will release that restriction. They may make you responsible for travel expenses for the children so that the other parent doesn't lose any significant contact with the child.
Yeah, or revenue. Right?
Or revenue,
additional cost. So what happens when one of the parents is not allowing the other parent to have those normal visitations that have been outlined by the court?
Okay. So at that point in time, I really suggest that the parent who's not seeing their kid contact an attorney, because the attorney can go and file a motion for a petition for enforcement and make the court order the person to give the visitation. Why you don't want to have the court order you that is when somebody files a motion for enforcement against you, it's for enforcement and contempt. And contempt of court can hold up to 180-day jail time.
Wow.
As well as up to $500 per incident that you failed to hand the child over. So if you're supposed to hand the child over for a two-hour dinner on Thursday, failing to do so could cost you $500 in court. In addition, if the court finds that you violated the order, you're also going to have to pay the other side's reasonable and necessary attorney's fees. So just deciding all on your own that you don't want the other parent to see the child could be a very costly mistake. If you don't feel the other parent should see the child, talk to an attorney and get the orders changed.
All right, let's switch gears again back to business. So I want to talk about mindset because when you're going through the process, of course, of building out a law firm, all the challenges that not only come from the work, but also from the business side of it, which I think you've dealt with it extremely intelligently by finding a coach in that particular field that can help you come up with solutions along the way. So you're not starting from zero. You actually got a little bit of a head start when you got a coach like that, which I'm a huge fan of. But let's talk about mindset. So what is that mindset that you bring to creating this law firm? Obviously, we know your backstory, but what's your mindset? Is it, in your own words, what's your mindset for building out this law firm?
I guess my law firm, I mean, it's not a member of the family, but I've really enjoyed creating it. I do feel I can make a difference in the field by creating a safer place for clients to go to, a different culture for the attorneys where they can have a work-life balance. My mindset. As much as I enjoy law, and I do enjoy law, and I keep my passion on the law side, I don't on the business decisions, but I keep it on the law side, I really enjoy running a business. I enjoy teaching others. I enjoy the organization. I enjoy coming up with policy systems and procedures, determining what our menu is that we offer. And I enjoy that running the business. That's more of my background. And I really, and that may also be what helps me keep my sanity when I'm dealing with
a lot of
drama.
Absolutely, I was going to say that. So all entrepreneurs should work in the business and know how to execute, how to be a great attorney, how to be, in my case, create marketing, in your case, actually execute on coaching. But you should also be able to work on the business. So on the business is not day-to-day, is not meeting with clients, it's strategically thinking about, do I want to keep a certain segment of my offerings in your, virtual assistant world, right? Do I want to continue to have this offering? But because these three things are bringing in more revenue and our clients are a lot more satisfied with this portion of it, and this isn't making me money, maybe I close this division and then I focus more on this. That's working on the business. And I think all entrepreneurs should do that. But some get so bogged down with working in the business that they don't see the forest through the trees, right?
But also I think it's like a blessing to kind of have enjoyment in doing that. Like I am very much the same way. I sat down this weekend and it was like mapping out customer experience process, and that helped me find all these things I wanted to do. But for some business owners, that is not an enjoyable task. They want to be able to, take this vision and just like have it be made a reality.
Well, that's me. I'm the opposite of you guys. I'm in the business all the time. You know, if you watch that movie Office Space, I'm the guy walking around with a coffee cup. How's everything going? I'm just walking around.
Oh, you're that guy.
Yeah. You know, I have to
nobody likes that guy, though.
Nobody likes me.
They do. Well, maybe not in your office, but outside.
No, but I like the creation. I want in. I want, I hear a client problem. I want to solve it. I'm in all the time. I'm texting them. I'm like, hey, look, I saw this. I should be working on the business.
You know what?
I don't look at financials. I don't look at,
but that's
God,
the thing.
Care,
like, you guys actually, and that's the point I was kind of driving to. There are personalities that enjoy it, but more often I find successful business owners with this personality because this personality says, you know what? I'm not ready yet, but I'm going to go do it anyway and figure it out along the way. Versus our personality, which tend to default to, it's not ready yet. It's not ready yet. I'm not going to do anything because it's not perfect yet.
Paralysis from too much analysis.
So having already jumped, you've taken that step and now it behooves you that's good. But I wouldn't have a job if there weren't more people like you, Howie.
For sure. Yeah,
go start your businesses.
That's why we all need coaches, seriously, especially these kinds of personalities. Somebody's like, hey, come here. Dude, what about all these things? I'm like, oh, you're right. And then you give them homework. Mm-hmm. You have to report back.
Hold them to
So we're going to wrap up, but we're going to go into the after show. We can get in a little bit more. Great. But if folks want to get in touch with you, Linda, how do they do that?
Oh, that is easy. Give us a call, 210-997-2914. Again, 210-997-2914. And if remembering a phone number is not the best thing, our website is myfamilymatterslaw.com.
Awesome. I appreciate that.
That's a good website.
All right. As we wrap up the show, quick reminder, check out our latest podcast and catch video version of the show anytime by visiting our website at satalkradio.com. It's going to be it for us for this one. You guys have a great week. Great job, Linda. And we'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome.